Talk given Sunday, 21st May, 1972. One of the most important aspects of the living of the holy life is the release from various illusions that we hold. And in this connection, it is very easy to be self-deceived as regards the extent to which we are really free of our illusions. There is a very good reason for this. Our deepest illusions and fundamental delusions are due to our very structure, the very structure of the psychophysical organism is such that many a delusion takes deep root in the unconscious mind. And it operates from there continuously without our knowing it. So we get deceived that we are free from this, that, or the other illusion, when in actual fact, deep in the unconscious, there is this force constantly functioning. You have often heard me say, death in reality is transformation. Provided we have been intelligent enough and mindful enough in the right way to enable death to effect a transformation, a transmutation, and not a mere pushing aside of useless material. So that instead of death in its usual destructive aspect at work, we have death, the transformer. And this is death, the perfecter. But consider our attitude to death. We are afraid of it. Every human being in the world, in some degree or other, until he is truly enlightened, truly purified and perfected, suffers from the fear of death. It is one important aspect of death, as far as our awareness of death is concerned. And therefore, we try to hide ourselves away from death. We play ostrich with death, bury our heads in the sand, and don't face it, and understand it. But there are certain situations where, because of our ignorance and fear and delusions, we salute death. Simplest example, of course, is in terms of memorials, in terms of ceremonies which are carried out when death has taken place, of sort of state occasions when, as we say, we salute the glorious dead. Yes, these things have their place in our life, but on the whole, we tend to shut our eyes against death. It's something not to be spoken about, not to be dealt with. And no one, generally speaking, would ever think or feel in terms of welcoming death. And in one respect particularly, where we should welcome death with open arms, we remain completely blind and completely averse from death. And that is with respect to the death of the self-concept, which is actually with all of us a complete misconcept. We all cling to the idea, the belief, the conviction of the immortality of an entity self, an ego, a limited, particular, finite atma or spirit or consciousness or essence of mind, or whatever you like to call it. And we cling to that as something which persists through time and space until it achieves or attains or through grace enters into a state of perfection, after which its immortality, again in terms of continuity through time, is assured. Now you see, this clinging to a self-center is the very root of all ill in our lives. The immortal entity self, postulated by us out of ignorance, is the parent of the devil in us, the evildoer in us. We must not understand this merely in a limited moralistic sense. That is part of the story only. This evildoer in us, which is the born of the clinging to the particular, limited, immortal entity self, compels us throughout our lives to be self-oriented. It is the root of selfness. The postulate of the immortal entity self is about the most tragic aspect of our ignorance. Let us try and see how this delusion arises. We must approach this with a completely open mind, with a mind, therefore, that is capable of being sensitive to true wisdom and is utterly compassionate. If it is utterly compassionate, it will never cling to self. It will be prepared to renounce limited self. Let us understand, then, how this situation emerges. If we look back, far back in time, when our primordial ancestor was evolving out of the restrictions of his animal condition and nature, and beginning to grow into that which has become man as we know him and understand him today. When that process was taking place, he gradually became increasingly self-aware. That is to say, he became increasingly, very slowly of course, increasingly conscious of his own inward intellectual and emotional processes. And he began to associate the idea of an I am I with that inner life of his. In the earlier stages, the word I meant just the living psychophysical organism. In fact, he wasn't aware so much in terms of psyche, he was just aware in terms of body. This is me, the living body. And as far as that goes, as a simple objective statement within the limited context of human life, that is perfectly true and straightforward. It is of practical use in ordinary, everyday, empirical life, and it serves all empirical purposes. When we say I, or when we refer to the me, well, it simply means this fellow who is the living organism here. Now, as long as that type of self-knowledge prevails, it is all right. It is only for practical, everyday purposes. There is no postulate about an immortal entity hidden within this living organism. No such postulate. But as man grew through the tens and hundreds of thousands of years, and he began to be more seriously interested in the question, who am I? He also began to ask questions of this type. Where was I before I was born? Now you see what had happened. In the subconscious, unbeknown to himself, the idea of a continuous I had formed itself. He took it for granted. Otherwise, how could you ask the question, where was I before I was born? The question implies the postulate that there is something which is the I, which precedes the birth of the body, and by the same token is likely to continue after the death of the body. Now this we can understand, because it's very, very hard for any animal body, and man's body is an animal body, very hard for that to accept death as the complete disintegration of that particular appearance, which is me. I don't like the idea. I cling to the ego. I want to continue. I want to get a reward for my good deeds. I want to obtain a final result of all my efforts for betterment, for all the sacrifices that I make, and so forth and so forth. So deep in the subconscious, this clinging to some sort of entity that was before birth and will continue after death is formed. Now this we may call the natural factor at play. It just happens naturally that way. Then there comes in another factor, very, very much later in the history of man's development. Different people have different interests. Some people are more inclined to philosophize about themselves and about life and the nature of life. The intellect sets to work and logically, as the person imagines, logically deduces that there must be some sort of immortal entity. Otherwise, life would not be worthwhile, the person says. It seems as if that is reasonable. But consider the implication. Life's worthwhileness is in terms of me. It has to be worthwhile for me, as I like it, as I want it. The world exists for my benefit. It ought to be for my benefit. You see how terribly strong the roots of selfness, of selfishness, are in us, in every one of us. Quite a good few of the greatest of philosophers have never been able to free themselves from this ineradicable sense of a permanent ego in them. So their whole examination of life, of the world, of the nature of things, is all the time in terms of the individual separate self. They are all self-oriented. Only the relatively few perfected holy ones got completely beyond that. They were really liberated from the binding influence of this self-belief. So now, when such people make their pronouncements, and they contribute in many other ways to the norms of life which are laid down for that community or society or nation or whatever it may be, what they say is treated as gospel truth by the mass of people. The mass of people say, oh well, we've got to work hard every day to earn our living and so on. Let the great thinkers and teachers tell us all about ourselves and we will believe it and follow it. So what happens to you and me then? This idea of an immortal entity is foisted upon us by people who are no wiser than ourselves. It is part of our conditioning, part of our, what we are pleased to miscall, our spiritual heritage, the promise of immortality for a finite, limited me, which is an impossibility. If one really wants to be even just straightforwardly, logically intellectual, it won't hold water. How can the infinite, which alone can be associated with the immortal, grant immortality to that which is finite? Because the very meaning of finitude, the very meaning of entity, of separate individuality is that it has a beginning, a procedure or growth, and then death. No finite entity can arrogate to itself or be characterized by infinite immortality. Even the intellect should be able to perceive this. But it's very curious that the greatest intellects in the world have failed in this respect. Only the truly enlightened ones, like the Buddha, for instance, like the great teachers of the Upanishads, some of the great poet seers of the Rig Veda, only such people have freed themselves from being dominated by this self-center, both as a conscious belief and as an unconscious force working in the deep, in the depths of their minds. Perhaps one may feel this is a terrible doctrine. It may feel awful. It may feel destructive. It may feel as if it makes nonsense of the effort, of the striving to live the holy life, the good life. What is the purpose of it all, we ask? It may feel like that. But now, let the mind be quiet. Let it dwell upon, brood over, somewhat like a hen broods over her chicks, or a mother over its infant. Let the mind brood that way, with loving kindness inside itself, and then see what happens in terms of your vision and understanding on this question. You see, as long as this acceptance of a self-center which is an immortal entity within us is functioning, as long as that is there, it is impossible to be wholly selfless. We are always selfish. Most important of all, our understanding, our awareness of the nature of existence is vitiated right at the source. We have considered this matter only a few weeks ago. How vividly conscious we are of ourselves. I am I. The consciousness of the I is extremely vivid, extremely strong. And it is this consciousness which strives to bend the whole of life and attempts to make life be related to oneself. And how relatively weak, vague, is the consciousness of you, the other person, that object. the consciousness of self, this little, this infinitesimally little bit of manifestation in space and time, quite overpowers the awareness of the rest of the universe, of the rest of the universe. The disproportion is just doesn't bear thinking about. Our conceit, and what a cruel conceit it is, because it destroys our understanding of the truth about ourselves. Our conceit is quite unbelievable. And it is a conceit in both senses, in the sense which is related to the idea of pride, self-conceit, that way. It is also related to the other meaning of conceit, which is an old meaning, a fanciful notion. It is just a fanciful notion. Can we invite death with open arms and pray death to release us from bondage to this childish, stupid, but most devilishly powerful, fanciful notion, this conceit of the limited I am, for which we crave immortality into a future as well as believe that it everlastingly existed in the past. Because if we can do that, and if this conceit can be dissolved, completely dissolved, then this whole world sings for joy that it has come to fruition in terms of the liberated person. You see, you have to bend all your energy in deep meditation, in discussion in your within your own mind, in the quiet way also letting your mind brood upon it, in order to work out all the consequences in everyday life of the holding of this conceit of the immortal entity self. Our conscious belief in it is, after all, partly effective. It is in the unconscious depths of mind that it is so very, very powerful. Because that is the source of a poison which lasts all through our life. If you can understand this, I've tried to put it entirely in ordinary English modern terms. If you can really understand this, you will understand why the Buddha taught the doctrine of anatta, of the complete absence of all egoism. Understand anatta that way. The complete eradication of egoism, the I-ness, with respect to nama and rupa, with respect to mind and body, with respect to thing and nothing. If you can understand that, you will understand also why Nirvana is called Anatta. Impermanence, anicca, belongs to everything that is manifested, not to Nirvana. Nirvana is nitya, nitya, the permanent. To everything is ascribed dukkha, but not to Nirvana. Nirvana is not dukkha. To everything is ascribed anatta, and to Nirvana also is ascribed anatta. It's one of the great intellectual puzzles of Buddhist teaching. But understand anatta as the complete absence of egoism, of egolessness. If one sees that clearly, then one sees that the temporal, impermanent ego, the psychophysical organism to which you refer to as I, is there, but that perishes. Every element composing it perishes. There is no specific element involved, no particular limited finite element, which is the permanent, or which has that creative power because of which you and I and the whole universe is an existent reality. You see, this is very, very deep. This is not a question of mere philosophy, a system of thought, of belief, and so forth. This touches the very root and the very heart of understanding, of true understanding, of unerring insight, panya, of the very root of wisdom. If you like the Buddha's authority for this, consider what is said in the opening pages of the Mahavagga. It starts off with the statement of the enlightenment of the Buddha. And after the enlightenment, as the texts state, he sits there, steeped, the texts say enjoying, but understand it this way and you'll get, I think, closer to the reality. Steeped in the bliss of freedom. And he spends 7 days under one tree, which is called the Ajapala, or goatherd's banyan tree, which I think is a bad translation and a wrong one. But this is entirely, I take responsibility for this, and I'll tell you why in a moment. Then he spends 7 days under the Muchalinda tree and 7 days under the Rajayatana tree, and then goes back to the Ajapala tree. Now look, Pala means one who tends. Aja means a goat. So he who tends goat is a goat herd, obviously. But do you think the Buddha was interested in goats? I suppose there are a good many silly goats who would swallow that whole, the whole goat. Consider, Aja also means the unborn. What does the Buddha tell his monks when he is giving that famous autobiographical discourse, the Ariya Paryesana Sutta? Seeking the unborn. Knowing that he was subject to mortality, to decay and to death, he sought the unborn. If you look at that 26th discourse in the Majjhima Nikaya, you'll find some very wonderful things. He found, as he says, the unborn, which is nirvana. He himself says that, which is nirvana. So Ajapala could also be understood, couldn't it, as he who tends the unborn, the immortal, the stainless, the ultimate reality, the truth, the absolute, freed from the bonds of the relative, which means free from all conditioned states, from all conditionality. Look at his Paticca Samuppada. It is an exposition of the nature of conditionality, the 12 factors which make up the Paticca Samuppada, all explain that wheel of samsara, because of which we are bound in this conditionality. But the unborn, which necessarily, therefore, is the unaging, which necessarily, therefore, also, is the undecaying, is therefore also the deathless. A deathlessness which has completely transcended all time and space limitations, which has completely gone beyond all cause-effect. It is acausal. It is absolute creative energy, pure and simple. Pure mind, as the Buddhists put it. So, that meditation under the Ajapala tree is indicative of the fact that when one is in that state of samadhi, that ultimate state of samadhi, where nirvana is a realized fact, one is tending the deathless, the unborn. Then he goes and meditates 7 days under the Muchalinda tree. The Serpent King, that's the ordinary translation of Muchalinda. Muchalinda is the Serpent King. And is represented symbolically as a snake with coils. But serpents are also spoken of in various other significances. Not only in India, but in the Judaic tradition too. Moses and Aaron cast their rods and they become serpents and eat up the serpents which were formed when the Egyptians cast their rods. Do you think that they were just displaying a sort of a circus affair for the delectation of the Pharaoh? No, this is symbolical language to express profound realities right in the deeps of the soul. In the deeps of the mind, which has become free of clinging to this immortal self-center idea. The Muchalinda tree, then, the serpent king's tree, the serpent typifies wisdom. The serpent is the knowing one. And the serpent knows not only in terms of the play of duals confined to the context of duality or ambivalence, but knows with the knowing which transcends that irresolvable conflict of the duals. That is the serpent. He is the Naga, the knowing one. There is, it seems to me, I wouldn't like to be too positive about stating this, but it seems to me that there is a certain intellectualist emphasis here. The serpent is the one who has gone along the path of jnana, wisdom. He is a jnana yogi. He is the serpent, the knowing one. Now, under this serpent king's tree, king tree, the Muchalinda tree, the Buddha sits for the next 7 days, and a mighty storm arises, and the serpent king coils himself round the Buddha's body 7 times. And remember that in the ordinary yogic symbolism, you have the 7 chakras. Very interesting, the correspondences there. And he spreads a hood over the Buddha's head and protects him from cold, from heat, from the bite of mosquito or gnat or horsefly or whatever it is, until the 7 days are over. And the Buddha, after that experience, as it is said in the Mahavagga, having understood the matter, makes an utterance. And the last 2 lines of the utterance are significant for us. He who doth crush the great I am conceit, conceit in the sense of fanciful notion, this, truly this, is supreme happiness. I haven't got the Pali text of the Mahavagga with me, so I don't know the actual Pali word used, which is translated as crushed. It probably is the correct translation, the correct literal translation. But besides the denotation of a word, there are various connotations. It seems to me that if we look at it this way, we will get a more constructive understanding. Instead of saying crush the I am conceit, because the English word crush has the association of something repressed, something broken up. Well, you can't repress or break up that which is of the nature of psyche or mind. You can transform it, that's all. Therefore, if we say, he who doth penetrate into and fully understand this I am conceit, he truly knows supreme happiness. Because, you see, then only can the real fountains of compassion flow freely. Then only is it possible to have that omniscience which is ascribed to the liberated ones. Omniscience in the sense that you are capable of seeing the truth of things as they are. The real truth, undeluded. And why are you undeluded? How is it that you are undeluded? there is no relating of the actual fact to a self-center in terms of which you interpret the fact. You see what the liberation of the mind means. This is the sort of person who can see the simple truth. Observe how it works out in your own daily life. When any stimulus comes to us from outside, generally one of two main reactions takes place. This is pleasant, I like it, I want it. There is attachment, there is grasping. The other reaction is, this is unpleasant, I don't like, I don't want it. I'll throw it out, I'll destroy it, I'll break it. So there is aversion, hate. Attachment and aversion exist only because there is the relating of everything in our daily life to a self-center. But don't relate it to a self-center. That is to say, be so wide awake, so mindful, that the moment this evil reaction comes up, either to grasp because you like, or to destroy because you don't like, you will be aware of it, and it will cease to worry you. And you will see the truth of the situation as it is, and then whatever your action and procedure is, will necessarily be the right one and the only possible one under the circumstance. Again, let the mind brood upon this, and you will know the bliss of freedom. This is true. You will know the bliss of freedom. It is the same with fear. It is the same with anxiety. It is the same with all the darts of sorrow that we experience. The sorrow which is born of relationship, of relating anything to this self-center. Because of pure compassion and of the purified mind, you will certainly experience indescribable, intense pity, which makes you suffer in sympathy with what is suffering. But it won't be that putrid sorrow which the bulk of us go through all our lives, because it is all related to a self-center. Something happens to me which I don't like and don't want, and therefore I react against it. You see the significance of that reaction? It is the denial of life. It is the denial of truth. All these things happen in order to help me, to enable me to learn, to understand, and to grow into the fullness of humanity. And when there is the growth into the fullness of humanity, there is no selfness, a core of evil, core of selfness here to obstruct the free flow of transcendent energy and life into me and out of me. Nothing held back. The cup of life is filled to the brim and it overflows for everybody's blessing. But that which obstructs and prevents at its inmost root is this clinging to, not merely consciously, but unconsciously. That's where the difficulty comes. This clinging to an immortal, a postulated immortal self-entity. So now, relate this to what we considered, I forget when exactly, sometime last year or maybe year before. This was in connection with right mindfulness, with perfect mindfulness. Those of us who are attracted by and strive to live the holy life in the as formulated in the Buddhist discipline, others in the Hindu discipline, whatever that Hindu discipline may be, others in the Christian discipline and so forth. Whenever we practice self-recollectedness, to use the Christian mystical phrase, or we practice mindfulness, sati, to use the Indian word, don't we always practice mindfulness in relationship to ourself? Just watch your mind saying to you, ah, I am angry. Ah, I am feeling very generous and full of love and kindness. I am this, that, or the other. This is what vitiates the whole thing and makes it useless. Be rightly mindful, rightly conscious. This is anger. This is fear. Not I am angry, I am fearful. Because that postulates this mythical I who doesn't exist. Empirically, for ordinary, everyday, practical purposes, the I, the word I, is a convenient word. That is all. But don't get deluded. Because of the imposed conditioning from outside, as well as the egoistic belief born of fear that there is a perpetual I. So you see how you can relate, how you can learn to be rightly mindful if you are awake to this imposition of the self-concept. Now one last point. I think I've strained your attention quite a lot today. But one last point. Is the end then a blank? Is this a doctrine of annihilation? Not at all. Do you therefore expect me to say the contrary and say that everything is everlasting? That statement is equally misleading and untrue. Approach the matter this way. Leave aside the so-called positive assertion of eternal reality in a substantial way. Leave aside the assertion that the end is a complete destruction or a total annihilation. Both statements are misleading statements. reality can never be known by the mind functioning in the context of sense perception and logical intellectual deduction from those sense perceptions. You can never know transcendent reality that way. You can know relative reality because there is something to compare. But the moment you are in the realm of the relative and in the realm of comparison, you are in the realm of the finite and the particular. And the trouble with the finite and the particular is that unless you can transcend its limitations, any one finite and particular can often, perhaps always, be in conflict with another finite and particular. So you're in the realm of dukkha, in the realm of sorrow, suffering, misery, and all the rest of it. But now, if one sees through all this, if through right mindfulness constantly present, and through the entry into real samadhi, one becomes free of the whole sense perception, discursive thought process, mind in its wholeness, in its unified state, in its utter purity, in its own transcendent rights as the creative energy of the universe operates through you. And what has happened is that you yourself in that state are the reality. Remember the Buddha's words talking about this kind of thing. It is as if you touch nirvana with the body. This is touching nirvana with the body. Let me put it in what I feel is some slightly clearer form in the English language. Nirvana is in you and through you, without any obstruction by you, the living psychophysical body. So, this reality, this spiritual fulfillment of our existence on this planet, can never be known as an object of perception, but is realized, made real, by yourself becoming that reality. And in the state of that having become that reality, the discursive mind can never know it. It's only after it has happened, or after each occasion on which it happens, that the impress made on the organism is so powerful, so extraordinary, that the brain can reconstruct the happening and give it an intellectual, verbal form. Now, if one is not free of this inner self-center, this self-centeredness, one will take hold of the words and bend one's efforts to achieve this desirable goal. You will invariably and inevitably fail utterly and miserably. You may succeed in deceiving yourself. You had a wonderful experience. Oh, yes, yes, you had a wonderful experience, but that wasn't the reality. You know, you can't go and capture God and take him prisoner. I can live in a house. The house can't live inside me. The house contains me. God is like space, like truth, like the absolute. So I can't capture God. And then in my conceit and pride, you know, wave a flag and say, "Hey ho, ladies and gentlemen, I've got God in my pocket with me. Come along." Can't do it that way. Just be simple. Let go. Completely let go everything. And the eternal reality will shine through you in utter fulfillment. And you will be a center of benediction upon your whole environment.